So I want to start off with this question for us this morning. Have you ever felt privilege? Have you ever felt privilege? Almost 10 years ago, I helped lead a group from our church to China. We led a cultural exchange trip there and had an amazing time. We spent almost 3 weeks there, loved the Chinese culture, the people. It was a phenomenal trip. When we checked in to go home, we got to the airport in Hong Kong, and the agent passed me my boarding pass, and it had a different color to it, and it had those words that every traveler longs to see: business class. You see, our sales manager of Cathay Pacific went to our church. He's moved to another city now, but he was working there, and it was a perk that I guess he put in the system that I didn't know about. And honestly, I felt like Charlie, who had just won a Willy Wonka golden ticket. It was like, no way, this is unbelievable. No extra cost, no one else from our team but me. And it was a 14-hour flight. So can you imagine this? Like, look at this. When you get on the airplane, you know, it's like you normally turn right because the left is for those people. I was one of those people. What would you want for 14 hours? Like, is it a decision that is hard to make? No, it was awesome. I get there, they call me by name. And I had heard of rumors of Cathay Pacific business class already. You know, like the biggest rumor I heard is that they serve Haagen-Dazs anytime you want it. And I was so excited about that. They called me by name, gave me a refreshment kit. I had a whole different menu and about 500 movies, which 10 years ago was like everyone else had one. It was awesome. And then right away, as I sat down, I'm like, hi, can I have a Haagen-Dazs? I just want to test that out. They're like, coming right up. And I'm like, this is the best. This is the best ever. I was about into my third movie, and one of our teammates, team members came up and sat at my feet, not meaning to, but they literally sat down there, leaning against her, like, so how is everything up here? How's it going? And I started talking to me, and right away, the flight attendant came over and said, ma'am, you've got to go back to your seat. And as she left, you know, I could hear her like, we need a society without classes. But I just went to the flight attendant, and I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, commoners, right? Like, they just try to do this all the time. But it was an awesome flight. I mean, I was so glad to come home and see my family, but it was an awesome flight. I got to tell you, it was great. I got to tell you, I felt glorious. And I don't mean this to say that I felt arrogant, that I would just wave and want, you know, everybody in economy and tell them where I was. I wasn't arrogant about it, but there was something glorious about it in the sense that I felt this weight of glory in a beautiful way. I felt recognized. They called me by name and gave me a copious amount of Haagen-Dazs ice cream, and I felt glorious. I felt privileged. Have you ever felt like that in other areas? Maybe you have flown first class or business class, but maybe there's other ways. Maybe you grew up and one of your teachers in class just you got along with, you just clicked with, and there was an assignment maybe you handed in or a test you wrote, and you know you didn't do that grade on it, but you got an A. With kind of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, while all of your other friends got B's and C's and worse. But just because of a relationship, you felt privileged because of that. Maybe you've been to Disneyland, and you know they've instituted something there that is so awesome, and it separates classes so quickly. It's called Fast Pass, and Fast Pass is awesome. And if you've been there and you've held Fast Pass, you just get to walk past all those poor suckers in line and say, excuse me, hey, yeah, sorry, just going up right away, and it's a beautiful thing. Fast Pass gets you to the front of the line fast, is what it says. Or maybe growing up, you know, you're the child in the family that you went for an errand with mom or dad, and it ended up turning into like a two-hour date at Dairy Queen, and you got the extra large cone, and you realize that your siblings are at home eating healthy food, and you're like, suckers. And you can just say it right here. Maybe your sibling is here. You can just turn to them and smile. You're like, you knew you were the favorite sibling. You knew you were the favorite child, and that's okay. You guys can work that out later. But that's privilege, right? We know what it's like. But maybe we've been on the other side of that as well. Maybe you've had to be like everybody else and wait in line at Disneyland while everybody else has Fast Pass, it seems like. Or you've had to wait while everybody else seems like they have privilege. Michelle and I flew in November in Canada, and I brought my Nexus card, and I don't mean to throw my wife under the bus, but I will, and it's her birthday, yes, but she forgot her Nexus card, and you know when you get to the airport and there's the Nexus line with like one person going through security, then there's the regular line with 45,000 people going through security, and I just kept saying, you should have brought your Nexus card, you should have brought your Nexus card, and all I could keep thinking was like, where would we be if we had our Nexus card? We didn't miss our flight, there was no stress, there was no anything, I just didn't like waiting in the line because I had privilege, and we didn't have privilege because she didn't have it. So, yes, I've kind of forgiven her for that, and she's like telling me again and again, it's no big deal. But again, maybe we felt that way. We feel the tension of this, right? Of times in life when we have this privilege, this being favorites, but then we have this time of knowing what it's like on the other side of that, and the tension of not having that or seeing someone else have that. It's this tension of privilege and favoritism, and on the flip side of this, discrimination, that is at the heart of James in his passage in chapter 2. And we're going to look at this morning. We're looking into the book of James, if you're new here. And James was the brother of Jesus, just so you know. And he's the author of this book. It's in the New Testament portion of the Bible. And James is one of those hard hitters, is talking about, like, if you want to become a follower of Jesus, as we call it here, to become an apprentice of Jesus, James lays it out very clearly for us. This is how to do it. It's known as one of the most practical books in the whole Bible. James was the very first pastor of the very first church that ever existed. Like, can you think of pastoral conferences? Like, you can't trump that. That's amazing. For however big your church is or whatever, you could just... I was the very first pastor of the very first church in Jerusalem. That's a big title. And he led through that. And as he did, in his wisdom as he grew up and pastored this church, he writes this open letter called James, not to specific people at a specific time, but to all people in all time, because of it's just his gathered wisdom from what he's seen. And he wants to speak to believers about what it means if we're going to be serious about following Jesus. And so with that in mind, let's begin reading from James chapter 2. And I want us to start off with verse 1. So James says this. He says, "My brothers and sisters, believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, must not show favoritism." Now, I want to stop right there because I want us to understand a few things just for context. We've got 17 verses to read or to go through today, and we will get through them, I promise. But I want us to understand the context of this, because in a way it can feel like James is just kind of throwing out, you know what, while I'm sitting here and I'm just going on a rant, I'm just going to throw out some things, some big, heavy-hitting kind of topics. And one of them is favoritism. Let's just throw that out there. But he doesn't. It's because James sees this in the context of his church and therefore writes about it. He's writing this book to Jewish Christians at the time. It's not just for them for all time, but at the time, he's kind of thinking of them. And the Jewish people lived in a very Roman culture. Now, there was three things about Roman culture that you need to know in this time that James is writing this book. Number one, in Roman culture, there was no middle class. There was the rich, who were about 2 to 3% of the population, and then there was everybody else. Okay, so there was no middle class just trying to make it sort of thing. You were either the elite and you had amazing privilege, or you didn't have anything. Number two, the class you were born in was the class you died in, which is very different than our Canadian culture or the American culture, right? Pursuit of the American dream. We pursue what we can in Canada because we can say if we work hard and we put in our time, there's a chance for us to move up the socioeconomic ladder, to maybe have things a little bit better than maybe our parents or grandparents had it. And I hear lots of stories of that. In Roman culture, it was never the case. If you were born elite, you stayed there. If you were born poor, you never had a chance to move up. And number three, Jewish Christians were definitely not part of the rich. They were definitely not part of the rich. And so, again, if you're poor, you barely had enough to put food on the table. You never went to the mall to buy something new. That was just never an option. And you never, ever, ever went out for dinner. Now understand this. Again, the church, being entirely Jewish at the time, was entirely lower class. Being Jewish in an occupied state didn't bode well for the people, especially those who aligned themselves with Jesus instead of Caesar as their Lord. And so what started to take place was in this poverty, you've got all of these Jewish people barely making it day to day, and they see these elite Romans, these people who have made it and have all of this wealth. And then they look at their own life and their own family, and they start to say this to themselves, you know what, if I start associating myself with these wealthy, rich people, if I start befriending them, and if I start, you know, taking them out for coffee and they start to know my name and do these things, I can actually start moving up the ladder. This is my ticket to moving up and feeling this sense of privilege. And think about this. You know, it's like, in one sense, shame on you. Don't do this. Don't show favoritism. But put ourselves in that place. If the only way that we can find some way of getting wealthier and more known and put food on our table is by associating ourselves with wealthy people, the rich ones, the elite, wouldn't we actually be tempted to do the same? And so what happened is a lot of these poor Jewish Christians started to favor, in other words, give partiality and extra attention and extra things to these rich people in hopes of being noticed. And James calls them out on this and says, as a follower of Jesus, guys, this cannot be. This cannot be. And so we read on here with this example that he gives in verse 2. He says, suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in filthy clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, well, here's a good seat for you, but you say to the poor man, hey, you stand there, or sit on the floor by my feet, have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? I remember working at a restaurant a few years ago, and I met a couple that came in, and they were Jewish, and they told me, like, we got talking about faith and religion, and they were Jewish people that went to a Jewish synagogue, and they told, you know, we started talking about the differences of what our churches were like, and they said, in our Jewish synagogue, you sit according to how much you give. And the wealthier people were given the best seats, which would happen to be the front row. So, you know, the Hydes would, in this situation, would be like, you guys give $1 million a year or $2 million a year. You have the most privileged seat. You are front row and pretty well center. You guys are closest. This is the best. Where the people who gave the least, everybody knew it because when you came in, it wasn't a matter of just finding your seat. It was you at the back. So I'm not going to call anyone out in the back. You're like, oh, thanks a lot. But I will call out the herds, Gareth and Ed, just for example purposes. You guys would be like, we've like not only given, we've taken. I don't know what it would be like, but that's how it was. It's like, as we would look around, we would see the heavy hitters financially up here and the less heavy hitters back there, strictly in what you gave. And that's how we said, we just operate week to week in our Jewish synagogue. We have an idea on how this works. That's how it was then. But James gives this example, and he gives the example of two people. He says, the first man who enters the scene is wearing a gold ring and fine clothes. In other words, he is showing his glory. His glory is by two things: the bling on his finger, the gold ring, and his pretty nice outfit. He's a sharp-dressed man displayed for all to see. Notice what it says about the man, as well as how he wants to showcase his glory. As I've talked about glory at the beginning, and you know, sitting in first class, business class, I felt glorious, I felt important and recognized. This man walks into church and he wants everyone to see his glory. And not only is he going to wear fine clothes for everybody to see it, but he's probably holding his finger, visible, holding his coffee with it, and he wants everybody to see his beautiful gold ring that's very expensive. And all eyes, when they see him walk in, turn to him as if he's the prettiest girl or best-looking guy that's walked into a dance. Or Cinderella, you know, everyone just like da-da-da, doing their own thing, and all of a sudden, whoa, all the attention goes over to him. Why? Because there's a little bit of us that wants that. And we see it, And if we can't have it ourselves, we want it by association. Isn't that true? If we, you know, there's something in us that says, I wish I had the fine clothes and I wish I had the gold ring. But if I can't, then at least I'm going to sit beside the guy to at least look like I've got it. That's why I think we want to date the prettiest girl at school or the best looking guy. It's because of a reputation. You're awesome because they're awesome. And either I want the glory to myself or I want the glory to be shared by assimilation, which is what happens when the ushers brought these people in to the best seats in the house. It's because I'm doing something for this guy. You see, we all want glory. In the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the ring of power is talked about often. The one ring to rule them all. I know, I'll stop there. But there's a lot. But the ring gets transferred to various people, and every single time someone has it or close by them, if you've seen it, you know the temptation they feel, right? It's just like, I want the ring. And it's because if I wear the ring, it's the ring of power. If I have it, I have the power. I have the glory. People start looking at me, and I am worth it. Again, we all want the glory. When we have those amazing dreams about winning the championship game, who scores the goal? You don't wake up and go, man, that was the best dream ever because I got the second assist and someone scored the goal and we won, right? Who scores the goal? We do. And we're the ones being carried off on our shoulders, right? Or on our shoulders, that's weird. Carried off on other people's shoulders. When we have dreams about work and getting the promotion, we're not sitting there in the meeting while our colleague gets it along with the company car. We're the ones. There's something in us that wants to be center stage and wants that glory. We want it. We want the glory, and it seeps into other areas of life, not only in status, but maybe in accomplishments and maybe in finances as well. Finances is a huge area where we want glory because we think money will bring us glory and privilege. In the United States, out of a population now of about 327 million people, listen to the stat, the 400 wealthiest people in the United States of America own more than the bottom 64% of the entire population. To put that in real numbers, 400 people are worth more than 210 million people combined. Think of the wealth and the privilege that those people feel compared to those 210 million. I think that recent Varsity University College scandal that probably many of us have heard about only proves this concept that we are glory-seeking people. If I have money, I want privilege, and therefore my children should have privilege, whether it's done morally or not. Hundreds of people have now been caught handing over thousands of dollars to guarantee spots in elite schools. And someone said, this is only the tip of the iceberg. They said, in a year from now, we're going to find out as this onion is peeled back more and more, how many people have actually been involved in this and continue to be involved in it. And I read this just yesterday, actually, on CBC, on their website, on an article, that the most recent accusation, get this, came out of a pharmaceutical billionaire from China paying $6.5 million to get their daughter into Stanford. $6.5 million. I'm wondering, is Stanford really that great of a school? Like, wouldn't it be Harvard or like Yale or something like that? But I guess Stanford is a great school. But $6.5 million just to get them in there. Favoritism is alive and well in our world. We may think we're all equal, but we're not. And Larry Norman, my wife's favorite artist in the whole world, in his song, The Great American Novel, he writes a song to the American government. And he says, and your money says, in God we trust, and it's against the law to pray in school. And he says this, he says, you say all men are equal and all men are brothers. Well, then why are the rich more equal than others? You see, we may believe this. We may believe that all of us have been born equal. And it's true. In Genesis, it says God breathed his spirit. You know, this imago Dei is over all of us equally. But we also want to believe that we can have just a little bit more glory than the next person. Maybe not tons, maybe not $6.5 quadrillion or whatever it was, you know, but just a little bit more glory. Can I just sit in first class all the time? You know, and then I look at my life sometimes and I go, oh, things are good until I start comparing. I drive my 2002 Acura with somewhat pride and at least maybe satisfaction. And my son's in there with me, and he's okay to be in there with me too, until he sees a McLaren. And I don't know how many of you know what a McLaren is, but this is a McLaren worth well over $100,000. It's a few thousand dollars more than I paid for my 2002 Acura. And suddenly here's me who's thinking, I'm doing okay. I got an Acura. It's great. But I want just a little bit more glory because the doors go up in a really cool way. And it's way more comfortable. But I'll be honest. I mean, if I could trade vehicles, it would take me a little bit to think about it, but I would. Why? It's because I want a little bit more glory. I want someone else to see my glory that I get to carry. And I think I'm appreciated with my Acura until suddenly my self-deficiencies of how I see myself kick in when I see the McLaren. And so let me just press into this just a little bit further before we go back to the text, and I want to bring us out of this, but I want to just think about this. Why the attraction of glory? If you're with me and saying, yes, you know, I feel that. I'd take the McLaren too. If I could get my kids into college, all these things, I would love first class. Why is it that we feel so attracted to glory in one way, shape, or form? A lot of it has to do with this idea that we have to count for something. There's a sociologist that I read about this week. I forget his name. Not a Christian. But he says, we as a people are petrified of the fact that we will die and count for nothing. That we live our days just in this middle ground, unseen place that nobody will ever care, and that in less than a generation, our names will never be remembered. And so he says, in our time, while we're alive and while we have breath, we try to accumulate, we try to make ourselves known, and we try to be glorious, to know that our lives count so that we will feel favored. And if we can't have that ourselves, we will associate with others who have it. Talked about this idea of glory and favoritism. And it's amazing in James 2 that I love the connection here. This is where things really get interesting. So check this out. Let's go back to verse 1 for a moment, because I want to go back to the original text. In the Greek, we have our NIV that I read from, and it's pretty close. But this is what it says in the literal translation of the Greek text in James 2, verse 1. James says to his Jewish followers, he says, you must not hold the faith with favoritism with our glorious Jesus Christ. Do you notice the word that James uses there? James could have used any other word. He could have said, of our loving Jesus Christ, of our generous Jesus Christ, of our caring Jesus Christ, anything else. But he uses this word very intentionally, our glorious Jesus Christ. See, in generations before us and in the times of biblical times, kings would show their glory by marching into a city and displaying their army and their wealth behind them. They would be on horseback, the most powerful horse in the army, and everything would follow them so that when they laid siege to a city and took it over, and everyone's lined up and they're watching the king come in, his glory would be with him. Everything was there. In John chapter 3, it says this, the Father loves the Son and has placed everything in his hands. So we think it's glorious for a king on a horse with all these people behind him to be glorious. What about being there at the beginning of time? What about being there when stars were spoken into place? And when the water was created and separated from the land, well, Jesus was there with his Father and with the Holy Spirit. And then it says, as Jesus came to earth in John 3, the Father loves the Son. And what has he placed into his hands? everything. You think your bank account looks good? You think your house looks good or your McLaren looks great? How about having the keys to the universe and having authority over all things? How's that for glory if you want to be thinking about glory? Jesus trumps all of this. Jesus has all glory in his hands. It's told to us. The Father gave all authority and everything in his hands. And so what does Jesus do? Does he ride in on a huge horse with everything behind him for us to see his glory? What does he do? It says in 2 Corinthians, Paul tells us, he says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich," it's kind of like the understatement of the year, right? "Though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, through this poverty, might become rich." We have to understand this here. We are all equal in that we have actually fallen short of the glory of God. Spiritually speaking, we may have some things that show our glory on earth, but before God, it means squat. We have all fallen. We are all broken before Jesus. And nothing less than the death of Christ could bring about our forgiveness. Nothing. No attempt of our showing of glory in all of its weight could bring about our forgiveness except for Jesus Christ in his glory, losing that glory on his own volition so that we may become glorious. Do we understand that? Before the cross, we were all broken. But because of the death of Jesus, if we accept that forgiveness, we are accepted and adopted by him. And in the words here, we now share the glory, that we might become rich, that we might become people who share that glory. And this is what James is getting at. As that takes place, friends, we're not talking about James 2 of just do better. Just don't show favoritism, because as you don't, God will love you a little bit more. James says this: if we all understand that we are broken, if we understand that if we follow Jesus and ask him to forgive us, that we are seen as glorious, then what happens is we start to understand the heart of Jesus for this world. Becoming an apprentice of Jesus isn't about doing more or having more willpower. It's about aligning our hearts with the heart of Jesus Christ for this world. And what happens is this, is that we start to see that Jesus' heart breaks for the poor. That Jesus longs to be with the broken. That blessed are the poor in spirit. Jesus tells us a story, and he says this great master holds this banquet. And who does he have at this banquet? The filthy, the sinners, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, those who are marginal and pushed aside. These are not the elite in society. These are the people that Jesus flocks to, and Jesus is so close to them. This is the message of Jesus. In verse 5, "Listen, my dear brothers and sisters, has not God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom he promised those who love him?" Skip ahead to verse 12. "Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful." And we end with these words: "Mercy triumphs over judgment." As we gain a heart of Jesus and for Jesus for our world, that's why James says, friends, you can't show favoritism. Why? It's not because it's bad. It's because that's not the heart of Jesus. And if we're serious about this, we need to align ourselves and start to see every single person, every single human being as equal. And I love seeing this being played out in so many different ways today. So many different ways. Yes, we see discrimination. Yes, we see oppression and corruption. But I want to just point us to a few things that I see as beautiful things of showing equality to all people. Just recently, some of you know that I had the privilege of going to Rwanda. And in a country that is now 25 years down the road apart from the genocide that took place, 25 years later, the country is continuing to rebuild and move forward and are thinking about healing and moving forward constantly. And one of the ways through this is through education. And as Wellspring has come in, this organization, this ministry that is equipping teachers to teach students, their fundamental philosophy is this, and we support them as a church, and it's beautiful. They're a Christ-centered organization. But their overall philosophy is this: every single child deserves a quality education. Every single child. Not just for those who can afford the private school where the teachers get paid more and they're better equipped. It's not those who live in the city so that they get this and this and this. Every single child deserves a quality education. And so what they've done now is not only in the central city of Kigali, they've worked at training teachers to train the teachers and students well, but they've now gone into further other outlying areas that have asked for them to come, and they're providing the same principle. Every child in this remote area deserves a quality education. Some of the trainers walk 6 kilometers one way every single day across ravines and over makeshift bridges. If I could show you some of these pictures, I don't have any, but I just picture this, walking 6 kilometers one day so that you can train staff to train the teachers, because they say there are no favorites. Under God, all of us are equal and deserve this. And it's happening. And it's glorious. These trainers have captured the heart of Jesus. I see this being lived out locally as we have a team that almost every single week goes to downtown Langley to serve a meal to homeless people and those who need a bit of a leg up. And what I love about this is it's not like just pass them through the line and give them some food and wave at them, but let's get some food together and eat together, because there's no difference between us. We are all human beings created equal under God. And so why would I show favoritism? One of the beautiful things about Tim Schultz being head usher, I think he would have opened his eyes to this, but this is a passage about ushering people into church. Tim was one of those guys who never showed favoritism to anyone. Regardless of who you were, what you wore, what your reputation may have been, if he would have known it, anything, he didn't care. Because as you walked in, his hand goes out and he says, "Welcome. I'm so glad you're here this morning." And there's people who are posting, "I've never actually known this man personally, but I've seen the smile and the warmth of his welcome that I've come into church. And I felt equal." In doing that, he communicates, you know what? We're not here to show favoritism. We're not here as the spiritually elite. We know that. We are a church of the broken, and welcome to the gathering of the broken. Jean Vanier, a founder of a community called L'Arche Community, where people with disabilities live with those who care for them, he once said this. He says, "Until we realize that we belong to a common humanity, that we need each other, we will continue to hide behind feelings of elitism and behind the walls of prejudice." Jean Vanier started the first L'Arche House with 2 other people, which grew into 3 and then more and more. And today, L'Arche communities have been established in countries literally all over the world. To say that we are all created equal and we don't institutionalize those who may not seem it, because that's just lies and it's favoritism. But instead, we come together and we are all equal and we have something to learn from each other. What a beautiful saint. So where does the Holy Spirit speak to us in this? Maybe we're not going to start a L'Arche community. Maybe we're not going to go to Wellspring and teach all people. But how do we show favoritism or prejudice in our lives? So some questions to think about. Because with favoritism comes also prejudice. Are we quick to judge and show prejudice to homeless people? Maybe we see them on 64th and 200th, and our first instinct is to lock the doors and just not look at someone. Do we think less of someone who is rummaging through our blue recycling box looking for bottles? Ah, Maybe they just need to get a job. Do we tend to create our own narrative as we serve at Celebrate Single Mom Day as to how these single moms became single? Do we go to sit with certain people at lunch, maybe at our workplace, or invite the same people here out to lunch and forget that someone looks new, or someone has been coming for a while and you've noticed they haven't connected, or maybe you even haven't noticed? Do we show favoritism by only having the same friends over to our place for games night and ignoring the new people? These are questions we need to ask ourselves. It's not to say, man, I'm so glad I don't run with the elite and yearn for the elite. But Holy Spirit, how is it that I show favoritism in my life? And how is it that I can gain your heart, God, for all people, including those who are broken? Because we are all broken people.